So we are on part 4 of 6. Good to see you guys this evening. Let's see, my clicker is working. This is the Grounded Apologetics series. If you remember, it's supposed to be a 3-step apologetic method where, if you remember, we first learn how to establish the proper philosophical foundation, and then after that, we move into the arguments for God's existence. And then after that, which we're going to start next week, where we start giving some reasons for believing that Christianity is true. So in order to reach the broadest range of people, you're going to have to learn some philosophy. You have to learn how to argue that God exists and get some good reasons for believing that the Christian faith is true. So that's our 3-step apologetic method. And this series is usually 9 sessions, usually 9 sessions long. But we're going to just be doing 6. We've already done the devil's advocate. You guys remember that? We're all my friends from the devil's advocate. Remember everybody became my friend that day? And you guys all wanted me to go to hell. Remember that? and for those of you who weren't here, that's where I pretend that I'm an atheist arguing against the Christian faith. And then we go through the answers. So then we talked about the philosophical foundation. How do I discover the truth about reality? And then we went into last week, or 2 weeks ago, we talked about the existence and attributes of God, part 1. So now we're going to talk about the existence and attributes of God, part 2. That's where we are today. And just so you know, what's coming up next week, we're going to get into the reasons for why should I believe that the Bible is from God? And why should I believe that the gospel message is true? That's what we're going to be doing next week. So, the existence of God, part 2. There we go. So, here's what we've already been arguing. We're arguing that God exists, that there's got to be some kind of a supernatural being, an uncaused, infinite, eternal being. And then we're also arguing that this being is eternal, that this being is, there's only one. Remember how to do that? We could argue that there's one infinite being because there can't be multiple infinite beings. And then we talked about miracles. What was the first and greatest miracle? Creation. If you can believe that there was no universe and then suddenly the universe began to exist, then that means the universe had a cause. So something is prior to the universe and acted and then brought the universe into existence. And the natural universe can't cause itself, so it's not a natural act. So what kind of an act? Supernatural act. So that's what we mean, the very first miracle there. So if you can believe that there was no universe and then suddenly there is one, then you believe in a miracle, because that's not a natural act. And then we are going to start talking today about the fact that this being that caused the universe must have a mind and a will and is good. And these are the 3 big arguments for God's existence. Last time we did the cosmological one. Don't get hung up on the names necessarily of the arguments. But today we're going to start doing the teleological argument. Does anybody know what this one argues for? Design, there you go. Teleos means ends, as in end goals. So that's what we mean by the design argument, is I want you to get used to the word end. I'm going to use the word end a lot. By end, I mean goal. It's purpose. So if I ask you, what is the end of my eye? It is to see. If you're thinking, well, when you squish it, that's not what I mean. I mean the destruction of it. I mean the end, meaning it is directed towards an end goal. So in philosophy, that's what we mean by that, okay? End goal, telos. Is there any reason to believe the universe has design? So we're going to argue that everything that has design has a designer. You're going to see why we're wording it this way in a second. And then we're going to argue that the universe displays design. Therefore, what would you infer from that? That the universe must have a designer. There you go. So what do I mean by that? That the universe has everything has design has a designer. I don't mean like a pattern. I don't mean like a little design on your shirt. I don't mean like a little pattern in the beach, like the sand, the wind blows and creates little waves in the sand pattern. I don't mean that. I mean, what do you think I mean by design? Purpose, that's what we're looking for. Is there any evidence that there's purpose displayed in the universe? So I don't mean like a little pattern. By design, I mean the object's arrangement of parts displays intent, purpose, planning, an intelligible end goal. Like this thing was designed. What's the purpose of this? Yeah, it holds something up. Okay? Your shoes, what's the purpose of it? Yeah, support your foot, didn't get it, didn't hurt your feet. You're sitting in pews, what's the purpose of that? Have a place to sit. So things, somebody said sleep. So guitar, all these things are designed that they have parts that work together for a purpose. You can figure out what the goal is, the intended purpose. So the parts are arranged in a way that there's an intelligible end goal that you can figure it out. So that's what we mean. So what I'm saying is, if there is a God, this is what the kind of things we should see evidence for. That would mean that the universe, the world, is an intended thing. If there's a God, then this universe is planned. It has purpose. It's meant to be here. Humans have value. The humans are supposed to be here. They're supposed to behave a certain way. So that's what we're going to look for. Is there any evidence that things have intent? Because I'm going to say literally everything has displays intent. Like, what is the purpose of an electron? What does it do? Give you a job at a power company? All right, that's the purpose. That's God made electrons for you to get your power company job. So an electron does what? Do we remember this from chemistry? I got a D in chemistry when I was in high school, so I was a terrible student in high school. It balances an atom. Gives a negative charge. It also is for creating bonds with other atoms. Do you remember all that from school? Yeah, sure, we do. That's supposed to be what it's for. That's the purpose. So everything all the way down to the electron displays purpose, okay? So this is Richard Dawkins, one of the most famous atheists of our lifetime. And he says this. Biology, because he's a zoologist and an atheist, and he's really fun to quote. He's got some great quotes that we can use. So he doesn't mean for us to be using them. But here's what he said. Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Because I'm going to argue that what appears to be the case really is the case. Because he's going to be like, that can't be the case because that would mean that there's a God. So I'm going to say, yeah, I'm glad he worded it that way. He's probably kicking himself wishing that he did it. But he did. So I'm going to argue that there's a mind that is necessary to account for the design displayed throughout the universe. So I'm arguing that a mind is necessary to aim for intelligible goals. What does the arrow aim itself? No, it gets aimed. What does the aiming? The archer does the aiming. The arrow gets aimed. So what I'm going to argue is that there's evidence that there's goals that are being aimed at in our universe, all over the place. Intent, only minds can intend to aim for intelligible goals. And natural processes do not aim. They don't intentionally aim. I'm going to say that they are aimed, but they're like the arrow. They don't do the aiming. They don't think. Like this stand right here doesn't think, when I grow up, I'm going to be a table. Okay? They don't have any plans themselves. But they show that the source that produced them did have an intent in mind. So only minds can be the source of anything that displays intent, planning, purpose, end goals, is what we're going to be arguing. So only a mind can determine or decide things. That natural processes don't decide. They don't make any decisions. They just are. They're supposed to be random and chaotic. Now, the universe has design. So we're going to argue the universe displays intent. So I have a little acronym we're going to be using as a teaching technique. So a mind is necessary to account for the origin of life and the order that we see displayed in the universe. So origin of life, this is going to be our acronym we're going to be using now. My origin of life. This is my son, Braden. Where are you, Braden? You didn't get my drink. Couldn't find it. I think I left. It's like a water bottle, bud. It's in there, I promise. You didn't go get my water bottle. You want to keep looking for my water bottle? There you are. You're going to miss. There's, okay. So there's Braden right there. And Braden is made up of organs. So Braden is an organism. He's made up of parts. Now, we can go through and talk about what these things, the purpose is, right? What's the purpose of your heart? To pump blood. What's the purpose of your lungs? they have to breathe to take oxygen into your bloodstream. So he has all these parts. So you're telling me the end goals of all these organs, aren't you? Well, that's evidence of a mind right there, but let's keep on getting smaller. Each of these organs is made up of billions of cells. Cells are little tiny little machines. They used to think the cell was like a little blob of goo. And they said, never mind, it's kind of like a little small machine. And they go, never mind, it's kind of like a factory. And now they say, never mind, it's like a city. It's extremely complex and it's full of things that are directed towards ends. So cells are composed of about 15 different kinds of organelles. Organelles are also directed towards ends. They have a purpose. The mitochondria is the one that everybody remembers. What's that? Powerhouse of the cell. You're nice and brainwashed. Good job. Powerhouse of the cell. What does that mean? I don't know. That's what they told me to put down. And organelles can be composed of hundreds of proteins. We're going to talk about proteins in a second. Proteins are made out of what? Amino acids. Amino acids unite together to form a protein. And then these amino acids are composed of atoms. So you have certain atoms, and a number of them have to be put in the, they have to have the right kinds and right amount, that they unite together to form an amino acid molecule. And then the amino acid molecules, lots of them unite together to make a protein. And then those proteins are like little machines that do something. So we're going to look at this in a second. There's exactly 20 different amino acids in life, in living things. Exactly 20. Okay? We're going to represent them by little shapes. So think of it like this. These 20 amino acids, there's exactly 20. Now you got tons of them in you. But these 20 different amino acids, they all have to, if you shrink them down and you put them in the right order, you can build a protein chain. They have to be in the right order chemically in order for it to be ignited and actualized as a working protein. So these proteins do something. So they're tiny little machines that do something in the cell. So this right here is a motor protein. And if you can see that guy right there? That's actually, he's carrying a vesicle. That is a transport protein. The thing is walking. And it's walking right here along this protein highway. And so I'm going to show you a video in a second that this is it's an illustration, animation to explain how it works. But basically, this motor protein is carrying a vesicle to another part of the cell. And so it has these little chemical reactions where it's stepping like this, and these little chemical reactions occur in order for it to move. So that's what proteins are. There's little machines that do things. You have tons of these inside your cell. So this little guy right here, this is purpose. He's intended, I say he, like he's a person. I don't know, I didn't ask him what his pronouns are. But you can see it's like a little highway inside here, inside your cells. Trying to be relevant to today, right? So inside of your cell, you have tons of these protein machines and the organelles, all of these things. We can figure out what they're for. If it's for something, then that means that there's planning, it's intent. So I got a short little, I have a couple little videos we're going to be watching. They can explain what I'm trying to get across. So in this video, they're going to talk about the fact that each protein is made up of amino acids, and the odds of getting one protein to form in nature is just not going to happen. It's got to be intended. All right?
A single protein molecule, or an assembly of proteins fitted together into a specific shape. These proteins consist of one or more chains containing hundreds or thousands of individual amino acids. Biologists have compared the 20 different amino acids used to build protein chains to the 26 letters of the English alphabet.
Alphabetic letters can be arranged in a huge number of possible combinations, and it's the sequential arrangement of the letters that determines whether you have meaningful words and sentences. If the letters are arranged correctly, you'll get meaningful text. But if they're not arranged correctly, you'll get gibberish. And the same principle applies for amino acids and proteins.
There are at least 30,000 distinct types of proteins, each made of a different combination of the same 20 amino acids. They are arranged, like letters, to form chains, often hundreds of units long. If the amino acids are sequenced correctly, then the chain will fold into a functioning protein.
Proteins are arranged in such a way that their amino acids collapse on one another and form an architecture that's pre-programmed by the hundreds of amino acids along the protein chain. So the order of those amino acids inside of a protein is essential to getting the right shape.
This arrangement is critical, for if the amino acids are incorrectly sequenced, a useless chain forms, and instead of folding into a protein, it will be destroyed in the cell. As science reveals the intricate construction of proteins, Origin of Life researchers are confronted with a difficult question. Could amino acids floating in a primordial ocean have arranged themselves into protein molecules through purely random interactions?
Obviously, it is very difficult to imagine how in the primordial oceans, the amino acids could organize themselves one after another into the right sequence to form even the simplest protein. And a good way to think about this is to think about the English language and how difficult it would be to string together a meaningful English sentence by randomly placing the letters one after another.
As an illustration, consider the difficulty of forming just one line of Shakespeare's play, Hamlet, by dropping Scrabble letters randomly onto a tabletop. Only one of 26 possible letters will work correctly at each of the 30 sites in the phrase. The probability of successfully assembling Shakespeare's classic line by pure chance is determined by computing 1 over 26 to the 30th power. The result is a staggering one chance in 2,810 trillion octillion. Yet while these odds are beyond comprehension, they seem almost reasonable when compared to the probability of randomly forming just one of the simplest protein molecules known to science. The smallest proteins in nature are comprised of about 100 amino acids. These chemical components must align in specific positions along a chain. Biologists have estimated that on a planet covered by a primordial soup, filled with complete sets of all 20 types of amino acids, the time necessary to construct a functional protein of 100 units would be roughly equivalent to the oldest estimated age of the universe multiplied by 10 to the 60th power. But despite this inconceivable time frame, even if our protein somehow correctly self-assembled, the mystery of life's origin is still far from resolved.
Let's just say that against all odds, against everything we know about science, you do get 100 amino acid long protein by chance. What do you have? Well, you have one protein. That's it. We don't have life because even the simplest cell requires over 600 proteins in order for it to be functional, in order for it to be alive. So mainstream scientists no longer think that life and the building blocks of life could originate by chance. They're now looking for a way to explain the building blocks and explain life's organization by some form of law or combination of laws that would allow that to happen. Chance is no longer an option.
In other words, you ain't gonna get a cell. You can't even get the little walking protein guide, because you have to have the right amino acids in the right order, and they cause a chemical reaction within it. And then we're going to see in a second, it also has to be folded the right way. That's to get one protein. That's not life. That's like one little chemical machine that you have. All right? So what kind of thing then could produce the right materials for life, but then also select the right parts from the materials and then organize the right parts in the right order and then also protect it? Anybody else want to give me water? My own son did not give me my water. It's somewhere in that bathroom. I think. Anyway, what was I saying? Something about what kind of thing can produce the right materials, select the right materials, organize it in the right order, in the right way, and then protect it while it's forming. because if you have the amino acids start to collect together, if you put them together bit by bit, it dissolves within seconds. That's why you have to have it actually all together at the same time and in the right order in order for it to be activated, so it actually causes the chemical currents to go through it to keep it, to hold it in place. Okay, so what kind of thing can assemble it in the right place at the right time? And it's for a purpose. What kind of thing would do that? A mind. That's what we're arguing. It's nature's natural processes are just not going to do it. And as they said, it would take way longer than the oldest age of the universe that any scientist who thinks that the Earth is really old. It would take way longer than that to get one protein. So odds are it ain't going to happen. So right conditions. This is the Goldilocks principle. It's got to be, you've heard this before, right? The Earth has to be in the right place, has to have the right gases, the right rotation speed. Everything has to be, you know, not too hot, not too cold, or else we're not going to live. So it's got to be just right in order to have life. The opportunity for death, really easy to have death. There's a narrow window of opportunity that permits for a life, in order to have a life-permitting universe. So think of it like this. There's actually hundreds of these examples, but think of it as though each of these knobs has to be turned to the right degree. But you have to have the right amount of oxygen, not too much, not too little, the right amount of CO2, the right rotation speed, right of the Earth, right location in the solar system and in the galaxy, etc. All of these have to be the right way, or else we're not going to live. The odds of getting one, well, that's not too bad. Getting two of these knobs turned, okay, three, four, five, once you start to getting eight of them, or a couple hundred of them, in other words, it's not going to happen. It looks intentional. So for life to exist, we have to have the right location in the galaxy. Too close to the galactic core, we get radiated. And it has to be the right location in the solar system. We have to have the right distance from the sun. We have to have the right gravitational interaction between the Earth and the sun. And NASA has estimated that the gravitational interaction, that's 37 zeros. I don't know how they calculated it, but that's 37 zeros, 0.0007 degrees, 0.0001 at 37 zeros. If you tweak the gravitational interaction between the Earth and the sun just a hair, you can't have life. Also, there's the moon interaction, gravitational interaction with the Earth. And you also have the rotation speed. Can't be too fast. Then you have the winds are too strong. Then everything's a disco. Night, day, night, day, night, day, night, day. If it's too slow, everything's going to get fried on one side, and it's going to freeze on the other. It's just right. We're spinning like a nice rotisserie chicken where they bake us just enough so we're not overcooked and we're undercooked. Also, right oxygen level, right around 21%. Can't be too much higher than that or too low. If it's too high, if you have too much oxygen, things combust very easily. So if you have your corduroys on and you just whoosh, whoosh, then suddenly just flames just burst out everywhere. CO2 level and then the atmospheric transparency. These are just some examples. So what kind of thing could calculate the right degree for all of these in order for life to survive? Looks like you have to have a mind. So what we're doing is we're creating a cumulative case. But after a while, it looks like there had to be a mind necessary for this. Next, irreducible complexity. Have you guys heard this argument before? You can take away parts of your car and it'll still work, right? What can we take away from your car and it still works? Doors. What else? Air conditioning. The roof. Yeah, the windows, that's on the doors, I guess. Windshield. After a while, though, you're going to need some parts. There's going to come a point where if you take away one more thing, what's going to happen? It's not going to work. Same thing with your own body. That's what irreducible complexity is. Cells, organs, all machines are irreducible complex. You can take away some parts, but there comes a point when you take away one more thing, there's these essential core parts that are necessary, and you're not going to survive. That's why eventually I'm going to die. I mean, you can take away one of my kids. What else can you, what can you take away from me and I can still live? My appendix. One kidney. Yeah, take off my arms and legs. My eyes, tonsils, my hair. After a while, you're going to need to help me, though. If you take away enough things, after a while, there's going to come a point, you take away one more thing, what's going to happen to me? I'm going to die. And that's how we all die eventually, as there's some body part we needed that is no longer going to be functioning. And so in other words, we are irreducibly complex machines, that you have these cells and organs have these interdependent parts that have to be there simultaneously to work together. And you take away one, after a while, take away enough of them, you can't take away anything else or it won't survive. So what kind of thing then can account for that? The mousetrap is one of the most famous examples of this, because mousetrap has like, what is it, maybe 8 or 9 pieces. You got the board, you have the hammer, the catch, you got the little trigger thing there, you got the spring, and you got 1, 2, 3, 4 nails, about 9 pieces. Take away one of those, what happens? It's not going to work. In fact, if you change the size of them too much, you can maybe chisel some of the things down a little smaller. If you change the size too much, it's going to happen. The parts won't work together. Notice that the shape of each part, they're designed to work together. What kind of thing can account for that? Only a mind can. Because there's intent, there's purpose, planning to put it all together, hold it in place in order to hammer it all in. I got another short little video for you.
Science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus.
Notice all of the goals that you see. These are all machines that have purpose. They're there for a reason.
The messenger RNA strand is directed to a 2-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured.
So that's the protein right there. These are amino acids being lined up. This only happens in cells. It's the only place in the world where we see protein chains being made. Inside your cells right now.
When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function.
So if it's not folded the right way, it's not going to work. So after you get actually built the right way, it's based on the DNA strand. If you saw that, the part of the DNA is copied, brought outside of the nucleus, and then you have the amino acids they're lined up in place in the right order to build the proper protein.
After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
This is absolutely mind-boggling to perceive at this scale of size such a finely tuned apparatus, a device that bears the marks of intelligent design and manufacture. And we have the details of an immensely complex molecular realm of genetic information processing. And it's exactly this new realm of molecular genetics where we see the most compelling evidence of design on the Earth.
There goes the Death Star. That's always the thing I see. Did you follow all that? Or at least some of it? That there's these machines inside of your body right now that are doing something. That's just planning, purpose, intent. So what kind of thing, again, can build such, they're just complex machines, like a cell? You're going to have a mind. We do not exactly know yet how the cell works, everything that happens. But I think after a while, we may figure out how the thing functions. And the more we figure out how it functions, the more it looks like a mind was necessary to think this ahead of time, to arrange the parts, because all of the little tiny parts are directed toward end goals. And then as a whole, the whole thing is directed toward ends, end goals, in order to then be part of your organs, which are also directed towards the goal of keeping you alive so that you can be who you are and learn what your purpose is in this life. There's only a mind can do all these kind of things here. So now goals aimed for, as we've been saying, a house, that's not my house. My students often will ask, is that your house? No, it's not my house. Why is there a roof on the house? Yeah, it has purpose, right? So the structure of the house reveals the purpose of the house. Like the structure of this music stand, the form of it reveals its purpose, doesn't it? You can figure out what the purpose is by looking at at the form of the arrangement of the parts. So in a similar way, just as the house has purpose, that's why it's structured that way, so is your eye, so are your body parts. These things they show planning, purpose. They're designed for a reason, okay? If you were going to build a table, where's the very first step in the process of building a table? Well, before you get there, yeah, the need. I first have to have a need. You know what? I want to be able to like have my food off the ground while I'm eating. And so I have that need. I have that goal. The purpose comes first. And then what comes after that? And then what? Then the plant. Then I have in my mind, I envision what kind of structure would meet that end goal of keeping my food off the ground. So I imagine, well, maybe if I had something with like legs and then like a large like platform thing. And so then what comes next? So I start with the purpose and then the form or plan, the structure of it. And then what do I do? Then I go gather the supplies and then I conform them to meet the form of the design in my mind to meet that rational end goal. In other words, the first step has to be your mind. You have a mind that is thinking through and planning, has this idea ahead of time that something has purpose. So what I'm saying is the universe is full of things that had to have originated in a mind. You're seeing that's kind of where we're going with all this? So the reason why you would build a house, why would a house be structured with a roof and walls? To meet its what? Its end goal. To meet its purpose. Why is your hand structured the way that it is? Yeah, look at your hand. Why does it look like that? What's the purpose? To grab things, right? It's structured that way to meet its end goal. That's why it looks the way that it does. So is there evidence for end goals? It's all over the place, isn't it? Isn't there? So if you say that the eye is foreseeing, you have an eye in order to see it. For the purpose of seeing, these are all words that apply what? Design, a mind, purpose, planning. Seems kind of obvious, doesn't it? The heart. Why is the heart structured the way that it is? In order to do what? To meet its end, which is to do what? Pump blood. Same thing with the eye. Why is it the way that it is? in order for you to see. So it's end goal and it's structured. It all goes together, showing that there's got to be a mind. You think that people would have thought this through, right? As scriptures say, ears that hear and eyes that see, the Lord has made them both. Trees are aimed at end goals. Cells are. All of these, everything is. Electrons are. Atoms are. They're directed towards ends. There's purpose and planning all over the place. But for some reason, not everybody's seeing it, are they? So what kind of things aim for goals? Only minds, as we've been saying. Information in nature. What's the clearest example of information in nature? Information is when you have an idea communicated through some kind of a material medium. Like, how can I get my ideas across to you? What do I have to do? I can say it physically. I can do what? I can write it. I can act it out. Look at my facial expressions. Right, guys? We've had to try to figure out what our wives are thinking all the time because they always seem to know what we're thinking. It's like, it's very, very rarely am I thinking what she thinks I'm thinking. Like, what are you thinking? Nothing. You know the old saying, right? But I have to suddenly, you got to play the game and figure out what she's thinking there, right? And you better get it right or you're in trouble. So, but you can figure out from body language and tone. Like tone, like if you're like, ask your wife, hey, can I go with my friends tonight? Sure, go ahead, go. Okay, the content of what you just said sounds like I can go. But the tone, you only use that tone when you're mad at something. No, go ahead, go. Have a good time with your friends. I'll stay here and won't have fun. You can tell by tone because that communicates an idea, doesn't it? And so facial expressions, you can draw it, whatever, writing. That's a physical medium. Well, what is the clearest example of information conveyed in the natural world, not by humans? It's a code. DNA. DNA actually is a code. It's information. That's why they call it information. That's why we've mapped out a large percentage of the human genome. They can tell you which sections of the DNA does codes for certain parts of your body. It's pretty cool. They've been able to do that. So it carries information, instructions. The information is encoded in the nucleotides of the DNA, and there's instructions for building proteins and such. So how do you make proteins? As part of that, that's one of the things that's inside of the DNA. There is our friend Richard Dawkins again. Everybody say hi, Richard. Some species, he said, of the unjustly called primitive amoebas have as much information in their DNA as what? 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. And you want to think they got stuck together through random natural processes? No way. Because if you're going to have 1,000 encyclopedias of information, that's intent, that's purpose, that's planning. So watch this. I got 1,000 of these. So look up here. That means in that amoeba right there, here's how much information is in there in the DNA, according to Richard Dawkins, who's an atheist. So all of these. And natural processes are smart. Because it's not natural processes, right? It's going to be God, as we're going to say. So DNA carries information, transmits ideas. Only a mind can do these kind of things. Next, nature's limitations. There's a difference between nature itself, which does display design, and then natural processes, which are random. They cannot do the designing. Natural processes are designed. They don't do designing because they don't intend anything. So there's the operation is how the cell operates versus the origin, how the cell originated. So we can figure out how the cell operates, but just because we know how it operates, does that mean, therefore, it did not originate from a divine mind? Because that's a lot of times so what you'll see in the atheistic community, with they'll kind of think, well, in fact, Richard Dawkins said, we know how, he's got a British accent, we know how this cell works. I can't do it. We know how the cell works. We don't need to posit a God. just because you know how it works, that's not the same thing as If you're like, well, I know how a truck works, therefore it didn't have a designer. Like, you would never infer that conclusion. So there's a difference between a natural cause. Nature eroded that. Nature, natural processes effaced that. But an intelligent cause had to face that. Would you ever believe that natural causes, that resulted from natural causes? Is that probable that would happen? No. What about the men in which those faces represent? Could they form from those same natural causes? If you believe there's no God, you'd have to say yes. Okay. Now we can we can build a watch, but we can't yet build the cell. And even if we did build a cell, you can't then conclude, aha, I built a cell in the lab, therefore that proves you don't need intelligence to build a cell. So humans can build the watch, we can't build the cell. The cell's way more complex. We can actually synthesize certain parts that we stick inside of the cell. We can do that. But we're basically plagiarizing God. Like, look, God, like I made a little machines to put in the cell. It's like, oh, the cell that I made? You're copying my machines with little parts that you made too. That's cute. So I love this quote right here. It's from a biochemist. He said, if old fumble fingers, pure chance, did indeed put together the first evolvers, the first cells, under the rules of chemistry and physics, why, for goodness sake, can't we? If you're going to say it happened through random chance, why? How come we can't do it then? Random chance is smarter than we are? No way. Not a thing. So there's a difference between nature, natural causes that randomize, and intelligent causes that organize. So natural causes randomize, intelligent causes organize. Natural causes randomize, intelligent causes organize. Nature, intelligence. All right, so if you look at all these things, what kind of thing can produce the proper parts to achieve a foreseen goal, select the right parts, organize those parts, put them in the right place? Only what can do that? Only minds can do that. So if you were to look at this universe, remember our little you guys remember that? What kind of thing can account for the organized parts, order in nature, goals in nature, information in DNA, and the proper conditions in order to have life? Only what? Only a mind can. We would go, a mind must have designed the universe. And so that's our argument. We got another one coming in a second. Everything that has design has a designer. Universe had design, therefore the universe had a designer. So let's take a little 2-minute break. Just in time, man. Right there on the 2-minute break. So if you want to stand up, go to the bathroom, talk to each other and stretch, we're going to start back in 2 minutes. I'm back on. All right. Okay, so now the moral argument. So the teleological argument was based on design, and our whole argument is that there's a mind that must be necessary to account for the design. Now we're going to argue that there really is a moral law and that there's a mind necessary to account for morality. Now, I usually, when I give the arguments for God's existence, if I'm talking to an atheist, I always start with the one that we did last time. And I do these later. And I usually only do the moral argument, almost kind of like a defense. Like if I'm talking to an atheist and they start saying that there's no God, but then they start saying, and if there's a God, then he should be doing this, or he should be doing that. And I can't believe in Christianity because Christians are all hypocrites. And what are they appealing to when they're doing that? Morality. That God should, he's supposed to be doing this, he ought to be doing this. Christians are hypocrites. They should be behaving this way. It's like, where are you getting all these morals that you're just judging everybody according to? Because I'm going to argue that it goes straight to a God. So you'll find that people are extremely inconsistent in their views, that they'll appeal to the moral law to argue that there's no moral law giver. And to argue that there's no moral law giver because you Christians don't follow the moral law. We know we don't. That's why there's a cross. You Christians are all hypocrites. I know. Why don't you join us? And you'll be a hypocrite too. Why don't you come show me how it's done then, okay? And you're going to realize, oh yeah, I need the cross also. That's the good news. Well, anyway, so the moral argument is going to be the last argument we're going to use for God's existence. And it goes something like this. If there are objective moral values, then there must be a moral lawgiver. So what do I mean by objective? It can be used in a couple different senses, but what do I mean by an objective truth? I can't hear. Yeah, not subjective. Did you say not biased? Yeah, unbiased. It's something that everybody can know. It means all minds can know it. All humans can discover it. Okay? That we all have access to that truth. So if there are objective moral values, in other words, if all humans can discover morality, then I'm going to argue that means it has to come from a God. Why would I think that? We're going to talk about that in a second. And then we're going to argue this, that there, when I say argue, by the way, you understand what I mean. I mean like in a logical way. I've had people before go, I don't like it when you say argue because I don't like arguing. I don't mean like fighting. I mean like giving a rational demonstration. Okay, that's what I mean by that. So there are objective moral values. So if there are objective moral values, then it's going to be logically connected to a God. God has to be the cause. We'll talk about why in a second. And then we're going to demonstrate that there really are objective moral values, therefore there's a moral lawgiver. So the very first premise here, morality has to do with the principles of right behavior. If I say ought, what does ought mean? Yeah, and what does should mean? Yeah, there's a right way. If you're supposed to behave a certain way, if you should behave a certain way, if you ought to behave a certain way, all of that indicates a mind is necessary. Like if we're playing any kind of game, I go, no, you're supposed to do this. That means that there's a pre-planned set of what? Of rules. What kind of things are the source of rules? Minds. Minds are the source of these rules because they're ideas, they're goals again. That there's a goal for human behavior is what we're going to be arguing. So there's what we call ends for what we're directed toward. Humans have all kinds of moral ends that we're directed toward. Like if you look at us, my eye is for seeing, that's not a moral end. But we're directed toward honoring God, life, and an atheist is going to ignore the first one, so I wouldn't start there with an atheist. But I would say as a human that we're directed toward the life, discovering truth. Because if you're talking to an atheist, if you lie to them, are they going to be like, hey, you shouldn't lie? Are you saying there's a way that we ought to behave? That we're supposed to be directed toward the end of discovering truth and promoting truth and telling the truth? I would agree. As humans, we're social beings. So to live in social harmony, we have to treat each other a certain way. We're supposed to be forming families. There's a way that human sexuality is supposed to be. And lots of others. So these are ends that we're directed toward. So if we're directed toward the end, the goal, of being alive, what do we call those precepts that I follow? What do we call the precepts that I follow to meet these ends? If I'm directed toward the end goal of being alive, then I'm supposed to what? Act to preserve my life. Does that make sense? If I'm supposed to be directed toward the end of the truth, that means I'm supposed to be discovering what's true, which means there's a set of rules I'm supposed to follow to meet these ends. And that's what we call the moral law. The moral law refers to those rules, those precepts, those principles that we follow to meet our designated ends. And so that's why we would say that, why are there gender differences? Why do we have male and female? What's that for? Yeah, reproduction. Why are we different? Because we think differently, if you haven't noticed. And that both are good, but they're different. Why are we so different in the way that we think, the way that we react as males and females? What are those differences for? Because they're for something. Exactly. Is your wife here? Is this guy's wife here? That was beautiful. That was beautiful. We complete each other. Yeah, because you're made for each other. We complement one another. We complete each other, right? That's why we have these differences. What do you call it when you have a man and a woman who unite in a relationship where they complete each other, and then they reproduce and have a child, and then they stay together to raise that child? What do we call that relationship between a man and a woman where they complement each other and then raise that child? If we call the whole thing family, what do we call the union of the man and a woman where they unite to do that? Marriage. Marriage is grounded in gender differences. The definition is grounded in it. That's why we have these gender differences. And so if you're going to get rid of the, if you're going to redefine marriage, like the Obergefell decision did in 2015, if you're going to redefine marriage and say they can be between man and man or woman and woman, because the definition of marriage is actually naturally grounded in gender differences, it's not going to take very long if you're going to change the definition of marriage to then try to say, well, maybe there's no gender differences. That's why the whole trans movement suddenly became center stage right after the Obergefell decision, because that's what logically follows from that. Does that make sense? And so why are there male and female? That's what we'd say. It's because they're designed to complement each other to create family units. So that's how you define marriage, et cetera, and such. So the Bible teaches that, but natural law also teaches it. That's what we mean by natural law. So humans are designed to consciously and intentionally act to meet our designated ends. So if I'm directed toward the end of life, if I'm supposed to have life, then you would infer out of that that I have what's called the right to life. If you have the right to life, what does that mean? How do I have to treat you? I can't take your life. Because if I have the right to life, and you're the same kind of being that I am, means you also have the right to life. So it seems pretty simple, right? So if I have the right to life, that means, and you have the right to life, then we are supposed to be doing what? Preserving innocent human life. And so that's how we start building our morality. So God designed us to discover these morals. Or, like I mentioned last time, you can just use the Bible, which is like your cheat sheet. You can sit here and do all this philosophical abstraction and go, oh, male and female is going to come in with it. Or God's be like, in the beginning I made a male and female. And a husband will leave a man will leave his father and mother to be united to his wife in form of marriage. So, if there are objective moral values and there's a moral lawgiver. Now, we're going to get kind of deep here. Like, we always got to get deep, don't we? I mean, every week we've had something kind of deep. So here's this one. You ready? Follow me very carefully. We ain't got any daydreamers in here, right? Everybody's focused and paying attention. I don't want to lose you yet. So look at this principle right here. See, we just had the, comes on screen right here. Only minds can produce moral laws. Why? Because a law is a what? Is a goal. And only minds produce goals. Everybody understand that? Only a mind can produce a goal. Like if you're going to come up with the rules of basketball, you have to have a mind to do that. So only a mind can come up with these rules because they are goals. Well, now, if all humans can discover the moral law, then humans did not produce it. Are the rules of basketball something that all humans have objectively discovered? Or do we invent it? We invented it. It's not like people all over the world were like, there's this game we're supposed to be playing where you dribble a ball. It's got to be 10 feet high. How many meters is that? Who cares about meters? It's got to be feet. So if all humans can discover the moral law, then we did not invent it. Kind of like, do we discover or invent 2 plus 2 is 4? Yeah, we discover that. If I say, no, I invented it. I have a patent on it. I was in my mom's basement, and I figured it out. 2 plus 2 is 4, and everybody's been making fun of me. So if you're going to say 2 plus 2 is 4, you got to quote me. You're like, dude, everybody knows it. No, they got it from me. You did not invent that. What about the earth being a sphere? Did we invent that or discover it? We discover it. So all minds have access to that. So what I'm saying is, if all humans can discover that morality is real, I have not yet proven that morality is real. All I'm saying so far is only minds can produce moral laws because they're what? Goals. But if all humans can discover morality, that means we did not invent it. But if morals only come from a mind, what do we infer from this then? So you got it. Say it really loud. Is that the same guy who said that women complete us? This guy's on a roll. Did you say you're married or no? I was going to say, ladies, this is a... Are you married? Oh, you are. Okay, never mind. I thought for some reason you said you weren't. I was like, oh, we got a great eligible bachelor over here that he's... What's the compliment, lady? So yes, very good. You said it perfectly. Therefore, the moral law would be the product of another mind, just like you said. Everybody got that? And that's what we're trying to establish so far. So what I'm saying is, just as we discover 2 plus 2 is 4, and we discover that the earth is a sphere, if we can discover that there's a moral law, then that's going to go direct. Then that means it's an objective truth. If it's an objective truth, then it's going to come from another mind. Are humans the authors of human nature? No, we're not the authors of human nature. So that means that we are not the authors of the ends toward which our nature is directed. So if I'm directed towards a moral ends, that means that if I'm not the author of human nature, then I can't be the inventor of the moral law. So here's what I mean by that. I'm saying the moral law is something that all humans actually have direct, rational access to. We can all discover it, just like Romans 2 says, that you can know the moral law without even having God's written law. You can discover it. It's because it's encoded in our hearts, as the Bible teaches, okay? So I'm arguing that, yes, everyone can discover it. That's not some guy's invention. If it's some guy's invention, it'd be like some guy said, hey, I came up with this. Here's your copy and follow it. If that's how it happened, then morality is not really real. It's not really objective. We'd be pretending that there's a way we're all supposed to behave, okay? If there's a way things ought to be, then there's a way things should be, which means there's a way things are supposed to be, which would mean there's a way things are intended to be, which would mean there's a plan and goal for our conduct, is what we're saying. So what kind of things plan? Only a mind does all these things. So if there really is a way that all humans are supposed to behave, and that we can all discover that, it's got to be that there's another mind that is the ground and source and origin of that law, of that moral law. Does that make sense? They're all discovering that there's a purpose, a plan for our behavior, intent. So the moral laws just exist out there as little floating things. Anybody ever just bump into a moral law at the mall one day? Where are they found? Only where? In minds. They're only found in minds. So that's the origin of it. There's a mind. So what we're saying is, if there really is an objective moral law code, then that means there has to be a designer that is the source of that. That's all we're arguing. Now we're going to argue that there really are objective moral values. So first of all humans act for ends. You cannot make any intentional choices or acts apart from the idea that there's a good way to do it or a bad way to do it, or there's a certain way you're supposed to behave. Okay? We always do what our mind grasps as some kind of a good for us, even when I sin. All right? Why does a thief steal? What is his mind after it? Yeah, he's trying to satisfy something. He sees another man's wealth as what? As a good. Why might a thief steal another man's wealth and then kill that man? His mind is grasping killing this guy as a route to a good. Why would he do that? Why? But why wouldn't he just steal the guy's money and then leave him? Why would he kill him? There's some kind of a good that he's after. It's not really a good. He's wrong about it being good, but he perceives it as a good. Justification. Well, if he doesn't kill his victim, what might the person do? Identify him, turn him in, and then he goes to prison. And so his mind is grasping freedom as a good. And so killing this man is why is the route to the good. And same thing with why would somebody, a rapist, is their mind is after what they perceive as something desirable. Power, pleasure, something of that sort. Every time you and I sin, every single time, why are we doing it? That's because there's something that our minds grasp about that thing as what? As a good. Isn't that crazy? We always do what we think is going to be some kind of a good. When I sin, I'm telling God, you're wrong about what's good. I know it is good because my mind is grasping something that's pleasurable or, if you're angry at somebody, you lash out at them, that your mind grasps that as this is justice, I'm fixing it. Does that make sense? So we actually will twist it. We take what's not, it's not really good, but our minds, why are we going after it? There's something we see that is desirable. Like when Eve ate the fruit, what does the Bible say? She saw that the fruit was what? Good for what? For food and for knowledge. And so that's why we sin, is we twist it. We see it as a good. In other words, my point is every intentional act we make, it's because we're after what our minds grasp as what? As a good, even when we sin. Isn't that crazy? It's true that this is my son. Not back here, I have another. This is my oldest son when he was 5 years old. He had a little Spider-Man birthday. And I love this argument right here. I've used this with many atheists that I've known over the years, that sometimes if we're talking, I'll say, well, why do you believe in atheism? And eventually the atheist is going to say something along the lines of what? Why are they an atheist? Because they believe atheism is what? Is true. They're going to say something along the lines of, because it's true. And then they always fall into the trap. 100% of the time that I've used this method, it always works. And then I'll say something like, so what? Who cares if atheism is true? Just be a Christian. Because they know that I don't think that. But if I get this far in a conversation, they're like, what are you doing? No, who cares that atheism is true? Just be a Christian. Like, what are you doing? Like, yeah, I'm setting a trap, and you're going to step right in. Like, what are you doing? Why are you saying this? Just be a Christian. Who cares if atheism is true? Let's just say it is true. So what? Then he's going to assume, but it's true. What does truth have to do with your beliefs? What does he assume about truth? That if something is true, then what? Then everyone, if something is true, then you, come on, fill in the blank. Why are they believing it? It's because they assume that if something is true, then everybody, say that again. What? Should believe it. What is should? What is shouldness? What is oughtness? What is that? Supposed to. These are moral categories. If you say to me, because that's basically what they're going to say after what, but if something is true, everyone should believe it. What did he just give me? He just gave me an objective moral value. Everyone should believe what's true. Because what does an objective moral value logically lead to? Moral lawgiver. If you're saying there's a way all humans should behave towards truth, that means there's a plan, purpose for our behavior as it relates to truth. And so then you just say, well, where do you get this idea should from? Well, that's just obvious. Is it though? Are all humans morally obligated to believe what's true? He's like, oh, great. What are you doing to me? Yes. Wait, no. Oh, shoot. I'm in trouble now. I don't know. Well, is believing what's true an objective moral value? I don't believe in morality. But you do, though. Do you believe that everyone ought to believe your true position? See the moral language I'm using in there intentionally? What's he going to say? He's going to have to say no. If he says everyone ought to believe his position, what did he just grant me? A moral law. And so if I say, well, then why do you believe it? Because we ought to believe what's true. But what is oughtness? What is shouldness? That's morality. Are you following me here? That means there's a plan for our behavior. See the problem here? To argue against oughtness, you must assume that we ought not believe in ought nots. I hate you, Spider-Man. All humans, every tradition in the world, all we have world tradition that actually gives an account to this fact that there really is a moral law. So it's evident that we know the law by our reactions, often, instead of our actions. What happens if you lie to the liar, cheat on the cheater, steal from the thief? They say, hey, you shouldn't do that. So we often know people know the moral law by their reactions. If morality isn't really real, then what in the world did Congress do it? Nothing good. Did you guys see the State of the Union last night? That was riot if you didn't get to see it. That was very entertaining. Anybody watch it last night? The whole thing I thought was great. They're just all like yelling back. I feel guilty for being entertained by everybody yelling like that. It was almost like British Parliament, if you ever watched that. How in the world would Congress, if there's such a thing as morality, how would they know how they're supposed to vote on an issue? If you say, well, the majority opinion gets to decide what's moral, how would the majority know? There's got to be some kind of a standard they're going to appeal to. Protests against injustice would not make sense if there's no such thing as morality. Judging a law to be unjust, how could you do that? Because atheists are going to say, hey, this ought to be a law. What do you mean ought? Where'd you get that from? You're borrowing from my worldview. How could you know if things are progressing morally? Could you? Progressing toward what? Toward some kind of a fixed standard? If you have two societies that disagree with each other, how would you know who is right? If society gets to determine right and wrong, both societies have to be measured by some kind of a standard. How could you know if the United States was correct and the Nazis were not? If there's no fixed standard, you couldn't. And if society determines morality, then was the Holocaust really wrong? If a society gets to decide what's right and wrong, what does that mean about the Holocaust for the Germans? It means it was right. If each society can determine right and wrong, then you can't say that the Holocaust was wrong. So, and before the Nazis ever killed anybody, they knew they had to declare the Jews what? Non-humans. How do they know to do that? Because even the wicked Nazis actually understood that humans have the right to life. They just said that the Jews were what? Not human. You can justify enslaving somebody, killing the unborn in the womb by declaring that these are not humans. Okay? Is morality an illusion? Which way is up? Which way is down? Okay, I'm going to speed through some things because we're basically out of time. I got one more minute. So the argument is, if there are objective moral values, there's a moral lawgiver. There are objective moral values, so there must be a moral lawgiver. If you're going to argue against the moral law, or if you're going to try to say evil, if there's a God, why is there evil? Well, if you're an atheist, what should you believe about evil? That it's not real. It's a social construct. If you say evil is real, you just granted me that there's a way things are supposed to be. That belongs in the theistic worldview, in our worldview. Now, all these arguments we've been using, you can actually demonstrate the kind of God that must exist. An infinite, uncaused God with a mind, the ground of goodness from what the moral law teaches. But this is one thing I want to end on. This is one of my favorite things here. I've used this argument to quickly run through. If I'm talking to somebody and I don't have a lot of time, if they're an atheist and they want to hear a good reason for believing in God, this is kind of like my quick go-to argument. As I'll say, well, which one has superior explanatory power? Atheism or theism? Because we're theists as Christians. Which one explains the existence of the universe? Would you ever say, there's no God, that's why there's a universe? Or if you said there is a God, that would explain why there's a universe. Which one is a better explanation? there is a God, that's why there's a universe. Why is there order in the universe? There's no God, that's why there's order in the universe. You'd never say that. Would God explain order? Yeah, the universe is intelligible. Well, if there's no God, we would expect the universe to be intelligible. If there is a God, would you expect the universe to be intelligible? Yeah, what about the laws of logic? You can't have contradictions. There's no God, that's why logic is real. That doesn't make any sense. What about biological life? That we'd expect there to be living things if there's no God. That doesn't make any sense. If there's a God, does that explain why there's living things? Yes, what about the goals in nature? Write down the list, man. After a while, you end up realizing atheism has zero explanatory power. It explains nothing. How are we losing to these guys? The naturalistic worldview dominates everything in our culture. It's dominating the worldview of a lot of our politicians, of the media, entertainment. Everybody see the little satanic Grammys thing? Oh, you got to see it if you didn't. They're trying to trigger us Christians. Like, oh, look at the guy with the little horns on his hat. Aren't you triggered, Christians? Oh, yes. You're so bad. What are we going to do? But right down the list, man, in academia, the naturalistic worldview was dominating, yet it has zero explanatory power. Christianity, as we're going to see starting next week also, is groundable and has full explanatory power. Atheism literally has zero explanatory power, and it's ungroundable and unverifiable. Okay, so next week, we got the truth of Christian faith. We're going to start. Let me pray for us. And if you guys have any questions, please come see me. I'll be hanging out at the end. If you want to chat, if you want to get a little deeper, I'll stay as long as you need me to. God, we are amazed, Lord, again, that you are the infinite, uncaused, intelligent one, that you are the author of the moral law. You are the one who brought the universe into existence through your supernatural activity, and you are currently causing us to remain in existence, that you are the one who is the ground and source of that which is good, of human nature. And we thank you, Lord, for revealing this to us. Now, we ask you, Lord, this week, for the rest of this week, if you will bring people to us that want to hear more about you. We ask, Lord, that you will give us conversations, that you will give us an opportunity where people will, that you will bring them to us so that we can talk about you and help people to take one more step toward the cross. In Christ's name, amen.